editor of Indian Country Today, member of the Shoshone Bannock Tribes. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Gainesville, Florida, on Friday night and in Melbourne, Florida, on Saturday night. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for internships. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Dina Guzder and Carla Wills and Tammy Warnoff and Sam Alkoff and Laura Gottesdiener, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Food for the Soul on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Tiffany Center in Portland. Food for the Soul is a potluck in the park benefit and will feature performances by Tom Grant, Michael Allen Harrison, Norman Sylvester, Shelley Rudolph, and Julia McKay. Potluck in the Park has been serving weekly meals every Sunday to anyone in need since 1991. Again, that's Food for the Soul on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Tiffany Center, 1410 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio, and KABU programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Columbia Land Trust, helping people care for and connect with nature in their communities across the Northwest. For more information, including tours, events, and volunteer opportunities, you can go online at columbialandtrust.org. You're on.
I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack.
It is 8:02, and you are listening to Native Voices from the Edge on KABU. Everyone, we are so excited to be back in the studio with Native Voices from the Edge. We have a wonderful guest in the studio this morning, Darrell Kalika, Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs tribal member, and many hats. We'll go into that shortly. At first, I wanted to start off our time by clearing the air. We got an email after our last show from a caller who just barely missed the end of our show to call in. But that individual was concerned that I was pro Measure 103, which was kind of hilarious and kind of sad because I want to express myself clearly. So, you know, I just wanted to throw that out there to our lovely caller who expressed concern. I am absolutely not pro 103. Or I guess that was a double negative. That's fine, though.
Right.
Y'all know.
But what you were talking about was, you know, also soda tax and talking about that conversation and what that does for, you know, our children. So that was kind of maybe where the conversation got sidetracked.
Exactly. Yeah. I think I was commenting on how the 103 may have been triggered by, you know, a preemptive step by the soda companies so that they would not get taxed.
Right.
And then I guess in my attempt to do fair and objective coverage, that I got a little unclear for some folks. So just wanted to clear that up. But we're very excited today to have a conversation with Darrell Kalika, who is here in the studio, the new executive director of, correct me if this title is wrong, but the director of the Institute for Tribal Government at Portland State University, which is an incredible resource right here in town that some folks may not know about. So without further ado, welcome, Darrell. So glad to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. I look forward to the conversation.
Yes, yes. So let's take it back a few steps and just start from the beginning. Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
All right. Well, as you already mentioned, Darrell Kalika, I'm a citizen of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I am, by background, a lawyer practicing, you know, in federal Indian law and natural resource and business law. So I went to law school here in Portland, but before that, I was a Portland State University graduate. And throughout the course of my career, you know, I worked on Capitol Hill, I worked in the White House, and came back and went to law school and went to work for the Army Corps of Engineers and then left federal service and went to work in tribal affairs and working on energy policy with affiliated tribes and Northwest Indians. So that's kind of where I've landed. And then last September, I took the role on as you mentioned, the director of the Institute for Tribal Government at Portland State University, which is housed in the College of Urban and Public Affairs, or also the Mark Hatfield School of Government. So,
can we take it back a second and ask what got you interested in working in federal Indian law?
So that's a great question. I don't get asked that very often. So really, it kind of goes way back, since we're talking about sort of the theme of politics and being in a midterm election cycle. I have to go back to when Sandra Day O'Connor was being sworn in as the first woman to the Supreme Court. I was just a little girl growing up in Warm Springs, and that inspired me, as well as having a relative, also a woman, Native woman, going to law school. And so it just kind of inspired this sort of desire to, someday I want to grow up, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a judge someday. I don't know if that's necessarily something I want to do now, but that's what inspired my career. But in terms of kind of specifically looking at my area of practice, really came down to the significance that natural resources played in terms of my family, my culture, and heritage. And so that's how I arrived at that. And then also looking at how tribal governments in a modern context are a representation of the collective voice of tribes, and that we're sovereign governments. We've always been sovereign governments. We've never relinquished our sovereignty. That's something that we've had since time immemorial. And so for me, that's kind of where that marriage of all of these things has prompted my career choice.
That's great. I'm curious, what did you do on Capitol Hill?
So I worked as a fellow. I was a Mark Hatfield Congressional Fellow, which is still a program in existence. I think I'm probably in the double digits now of having Mark Hatfield Congressional Fellows, sponsored by the Spirit Mountain Community Fund. But I was the second Hatfield Fellow, and I worked for Senator Gordon Smith on natural resource issues, as well as tribal affairs and immigration, of all things.
So. What was it like being there? Was there other representation of Native people that you saw in the White House, and what was that community like?
So my time during the White House was actually during the Clinton administration. So I think there was a fair amount of presence. I think the National Congress of American Indian had quite an influence on particularly placement of, because I was a White House intern, on intern placements. Mm-hmm. So that was helpful. I can't comment on preceding administrations in terms of, but I felt like there was definitely inclusion and participation. The doors were opening for tribal people to be and have a presence within the White House. On Capitol Hill, on the other hand, of course, there's at the time I was working there, Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell wasn't currently a senator for Colorado. And of course, the presence of Native staffers at the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, and then over on the House side with the Committee on Natural Resources. So there was definitely a presence of Native people, but you know, now we're in kind of a new evolution of that, seeing the number of increased candidates running for you know, the U.S. Congress.
That's right. Year of the Native Woman.
Exactly.
She represents. So for folks who are listening who may not be familiar with federal Indian law, I'm curious if you could speak to the importance of treaties and natural resources. So you mentioned that you got into this realm because of your family and your community's connection to the natural resources. So why are treaties important as far as promoting our continued engagement with the land and its resources?
So in terms of looking at, so let me take one step backwards in terms of looking at federal Indian law. When we talk about tribal law, it's that unwritten law that precedes the formation of a relationship between tribes and the United States. And it's that acknowledgement of our history that precedes the U.S., precedes the state of Oregon, that's important to recognize, because that's where the inherent relationship between the United States and tribes comes into to bear. And it's memorialized in the Constitution itself, with the relationship with an acknowledgement of governments being the United States or federal government, state government, and tribal governments. And so the way you form a relationship with another sovereign is through treaty. And treaties memorialize those agreements between two sovereigns. And so the basis of federal Indian law is formed from that that notion of the relationship between tribes in the United States. We are probably the only country in the world that has this unique relationship with its indigenous people. You don't see that with other colonized nations. And so a lot of what federal Indian law today flows from that doctrine of how treaties were interpreted and applied. And, you know, just right here within the state of Oregon, we have treaty tribes. We have a number of treaty tribes in the state of Washington. And over time, you know, there was a period in the 1871 when the United States said we're not going to do any more treaties. And so you have sort of this progeny of different ways in which relationships were formed with tribes via executive orders, statutes, acknowledgement processes. So that's essentially how that all came about. And in terms of the natural resource component, there were reserved rights that the tribes exercised in the negotiation of their treaties. Specifically, mine was the right to take fish and other important foods and resources in our usual and accustomed gathering and fishing areas. So that's where that importance comes to bear today in terms of protection of those resources.
Mm. Yes. So we were having a conversation, I think in one of our May shows, about the Bolt decision and the subsequent Colvert case, or Bolt 2, that was, I think, then, you know, contested after it was first brought before the courts in the mid-2000s, and then was finally upheld, I believe, by the Supreme Court in May. Amory's checking on that. But that was specifically focused on the Washington tribes and the interpretation of the treaty from Bolt back in the 60s was that the tribes could take half of the catch. That was how the words "to share in the catch" were interpreted. And then most recently, they interpreted that also to say that we have to remove culverts that prevent fish passage, and that we have to protect the environment, because what good does it do us if there are no fish to catch? Do you think there is any potential for law like that here in Oregon? Because I know that was very specific to Washington because of those tribes' treaties and those the interpretation of those treaties. But we recognize the importance of, you know, promoting the vision of the tribes that have lived here since time immemorial. As a Tlingit tribal member, I see myself as a visitor on these lands, and I want to be a good caretaker and help to promote the vision of your people, of others who have called these lands home since time immemorial. So we were having this discussion about what that looks like to, you know, both promote local policies here in the urban area that protect our resources and help, you know, reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and to make sure that we are promoting this vision of cultural resources access. So do you have any thoughts on either, you know, whether or not it's possible to have a law like that enacted that requires that we connect the protection of our resources to the treaties to, you know, strengthen that case, and or what natural resources protection looks like?
So, well, you mentioned U.S. v. Washington and the decision, the culverts case in Washington. We have the other version of that, which is the U.S. v. Oregon, which is it's an ongoing process. I mean, we're in an anniversary year. This is the longest kind of ongoing case that exists, especially related to tribes and treaties here in Oregon. So the U.S. v. Oregon process is an ongoing process that the tribes are continually engaged in terms of that protection of resources. The quantity of harvest annually is a process that the tribes and the state are working through. But I think one of the key pieces is really looking at, you know, I guess the way that tribes are looking at natural resource protection is in the spirit of stewardship, that one principle is to leave our resources better than how we inherited them. It's really challenging in this current environment and state that we're in to do that, but I think that's something that we have to strive to as a goal. One of the beneficial attributes, though, I think, is that many people in Portland, in the state of Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest, do share that common sense of stewardship and care for our resources. I think people are very interested in wanting to eat healthy, have clean water, have those basic needs met to keep their families safe and healthy. And so I think that those are not just tribal principles, but I think those are pretty well, you know, essentially basic human rights issues that we want to have in terms of protection. I think what's helpful is that those tribal treaty rights are one method and way that we can ensure that we're protecting these resources for the long term. Because in the tribal world, things are long term, looking at, you know, our phases of 150 years or seven generations, as opposed to just looking at one generation, which is like 20 years or 25 years, if you want to be generous. And so in terms of that, you know, looking kind of a long term, what our kids are going to inherit, what our grandkids and so forth. And so we're looking at that in terms of what we're experiencing. But the other feature is not just necessarily with regard to fish protection, because fish have also been a way as kind of an indicator species of the health of our overall ecosystem. And so now we're at a point where that indicator species is the layer that they kind of serve to be the test or the watermark of the health of our environment is now becoming more direct upon us as we're starting to experience increase in temperatures and climate change issues and increased catastrophic wildfires and concerns about ocean acidification and just a host of other things that kind of come along with climate change. We're seeing changes in the migration of salmon. We're seeing changes in terms of our first foods, when they're coming and when they're the seasons are starting to change. So we're seeing, for example, our roots and berries being ready a month to a few weeks earlier than they had ever been. Mm-hmm. So these sorts of changes, the changes in when the salmon traditionally would come back in the fall and the spring, that is changing. Mm-hmm. And that's all kind of a consideration with the changes that are going on naturally. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm curious, you know, as I hear you talk about some of these first foods, you know, I know that there is a really delicate balance between, you know, protection and preservation of cultural knowledge versus what can be shared with the larger community. Mm-hmm. So do you have any thoughts about what that would look like, you know, to re-indigenize our landscape here in the urban environment while at the same time not promoting, you know, cultural appropriation? Because, you know, we've been having this ongoing conversation as well about, you know, Native, I guess, I love how Louis, is it Louis Gong that puts it this way? Yeah. Inspired Natives, not mm-hmm. Native inspired. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what is that balance? Like, should we promote camas bulbs being sold in new seasons? Should we, you know, instead promote, like, the Native gathering gardens model where folks can, you know, reconnect to culture and harvest that way? What does that look like to re-indigenize our landscape and at the same time prevent cultural appropriation? Like, what is that appropriate balance?
Right. No, it's, I think it's a really important question because I think that's something we're all considering, especially as Native people, the sort of commodification of important resources. So, for example, not necessarily food, but, you know, sage bundles, abalone shells, and sweetgrass. Mm-hmm. Saw a small kit that you could buy at Powell's, you know. Mm-hmm. And then also hearing the concern from tribal people saying there's an over abundance of people gathering these resources to sell as commodities. Mm-hmm. And so it puts a tremendous stress on resources. Another example are huckleberries. The increase in the use of huckleberries, which is one of our first foods here on the plateau and in the Pacific Northwest. And it's harvesting time is usually in late summer. And so, but what we've had is this competition between being able to gather our resources that sustained us, sustained our people for countless generations, now becoming a commodity where you can buy berries themselves, you can buy jams, you can buy wine, you can buy all sorts of things. But it's also been this competition now for a scarce resource. Mm-hmm. And so it is that sort of fine line to understand. I think really getting to the heart of it is understanding where your food comes from, understanding mm-hmm. that relationship. I don't mean to romanticize the notion of, you know, that first catch of food or when you, you know, you hunt or what have you, acknowledging the spirit of that, you know, brother or sister that, usually it's a brother, that gave its life to feed you. You know, how many people are willing to go out and do that, have that relationship to take a life, to feed themselves mm-hmm. and understand that? When you put it, I think, in that light, people start to examine how close and how important food, water play in terms of their lives and their relationship. We're seeing that especially with water itself. You know, water mm-hmm. is a vital resource. And when you get past just the sort of, oh, I need to drink, you know, so many ounces a day, to actually figuring out where does water come into your life and what does it do, mm-hmm. you start to get people get really emotional, have an emotional mm-hmm. connection to when they start talking about some of these vital resources because you need air to breathe. You need water to have your body operating and running. You need food to fuel that. So those basic sort of things become really important to you. And when they're not there, then you realize how important they are.
Yes. And as I think about, you know, the water that we drink, the air that we breathe, I'm also reminded of the fires that were coming at us from all sides this past summer, as well as the fires from our summer before. Do you have any reflections on, you know, the impact? How is your tribe recovering from that? Mm-hmm. Was the apology sufficient?
I still have a lot of deep feelings about the fire that, not this last summer, but the Eagle Creek fire that occurred in 2017. You know, there's been a relationship with fires, especially, you know, forest fires and wildfires that were part of, traditionally had a role in terms of sort of ecosystem management. Mm-hmm. But to the level that they're catastrophic fires that we're seeing now, we didn't see that traditionally, where they're essentially incinerating the resources because they're burning so at such high temperatures that they incinerate even the nutrients that are there, and it kind of leaves those lands kind of barren, almost like what we saw at Mount St. Helens, you know. Mm-hmm. We didn't traditionally have those. Our wildfires used to, tribal people actually would set fires in the fall to help, you know, some of the trees that needed that heat to have some of their cones drop the seeds out of them. And so it was a way, and then to also clear some of that underbrush. So there, fire did play a role, but not to the level that we're seeing it now, not like this last summer where we're experiencing smoke from California and British Columbia, not necessarily fires right here, but that level of intense smoke creating problems with air quality and what have you. It is concerning to see the intense, and of course with California, the number of fires that they have this year, you know, so it's affecting all of us at a really deep level. So
yeah even the Arctic was on fire this last summer. I just get so angry when I think about that youth who started the fires, who had to pay millions back to everyone except for the tribes. Oh, an apology is fine. That just irritates me.
Well,
so much.
And I think we think about the impacts to us as human beings, but you also have to. I actually flew coming back from Spokane, was able to see the extent of the fires. Because when you're driving down I-84, you see a little bit of it, but when you see how far back it goes into the Mount Hood National Forest. You think of not just that, but how many, in terms of wildlife, was affected by this fire, and as quickly as it was, the amount of people that were there that day. Again, it's just this teaching of understanding of stewardship, that we have to take care of each other.
Absolutely. So what were you doing in Spokane?
Well, it happens in Spokane.
Stays in Spokane.
No.
Is this the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians?
Yes,
convention?
It was the 65th convention of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. And of course, the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians is the second oldest intertribal organization in the country, next to the National Congress of American Indians. For your listeners who aren't as familiar with ATNI, represents the collective interest of tribal governments from the Pacific Northwest, which is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Northern California, Nevada, and Southeast Alaska. And so it was it's the 65th anniversary. 65 years ago, tribal leaders came together, formed ATNI, and has been in existence since then. The array of issues that they were working on. ATNI really started in response to the termination era and wanting to push back on the termination of tribes and various policies. But today has become this sort of robust organization working on everything that, you know, it's sister governments are working on, the state and federal government, from housing, healthcare, infrastructure, education. So that's, we were meeting in Spokane, actually meeting at Coeur d'Alene. The Coeur d'Alene tribes were the host. So,
great. Yeah. And what were some of the topics that were passed? Because I know that there are resolutions and things that the tribes vote on. Were there any issues of particular interest that came up?
Well, of course, the topics of interest really are around the current election cycle, both at the state level, local county government level, and the national election, because we're seeing such a large class, particularly of Native women, who are running for office. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's the year of the Native woman. In terms of elections, especially regarding Indian country. So there was a lot of time devoted on the ATNI agenda four candidates who are running. And then, of course, being in Idaho at Coeur d'Alene, which Paulette Jordan is a citizen of the Coeur d'Alene tribe,
yes, she is.
And running for governor of Idaho, there definitely was a lot of time given to Paulette and her campaign, mm-hmm. as well as many other candidates who are running. In addition to that, again, climate policy, a really big issue, because we've seen efforts in Oregon and Washington to create sort of a market-based economy to sort of increase the awareness and investment in clean and carbon related matters related to climate change. And so the Measure 1631 or Initiative 1631 mm-hmm. in Washington, really kind of front and center, because during the convention, I mean, we're right there at the border of Oregon or Idaho and mm-hmm. Washington. So, of course, it's and Spokane and Coeur d'Alene kind of have that unique relationship of being like one area and one city, mm-hmm. but still across state borders. So we did devote quite a bit of time to talking about the initiative in Washington. The tribes have been very active in asserting their role and desire to ensure that their resources are considered, mm-hmm. that they're not left out of that particular initiative package in the state of Washington, that investments and benefits, should the initiative pass, which, depending on who you ask, it's kind of a... Some say 53% in favor, some are saying 53% not. So, mm-hmm. but it's a close initiative in the state of Washington, one that the tribes are definitely involved in, definitely pushing voters to get out to the polls to address. And then, of course, here in Oregon has been the Oregon Clean Energy Jobs Bill that did not pass in this last short session, but, you know, sort of reinvigorating efforts to ensure that there is some sort of market here for... carbon trading and what have you. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of that, should that happen, you'd have sort of this West Coast of sort of this clean energy marketplace. Yes. It kind of leaves a lot to be there. Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what that initiative is in Washington in like a quick few sentences? Or
So in Washington, it's been this debate between having a carbon tax and a carbon fee. And so part of it is the amount of sort of large polluters and mm-hmm. taxing that amount of pollution that is being emitted. Because it's being emitted now without any investment back into trying to balance out the ecosystem. Now, there's a lot of debate because there's still a lot of folks that say there's not hard science to say this, that, or the other, whether it's going to help. But I guess the general feeling is that some investment to try to balance this industry out with the environment needs to take place, whether there's science behind it or not. And so what that investment would be is that carbon fee or tax goes into a general fund to be reinvested in water protection projects or environmental projects or energy efficiency and conservation, things that are helpful to the environment. So
great, thank you. And I'm seeing now that we have Sean calling in on line one. Sean, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I don't want to distract from it, and obviously you guys know that for an hour before your show they were talking about the whole issue of Elizabeth Warren and the DNA test. And so I just, in listening,
oh, yes.
covering all, really almost covered all the bases of what that's really about. And so it's not necessarily a yes or no answer, and I don't want to distract from what you're talking about, but I am curious as to what your guest feels in terms of whether or not she helps or hurts the cause of all those things you're talking about, because, of course, she's a woman, she's a lawyer, she's saying that she's partial. First Nations, your First Nations, and these issues you're talking about, and also the most important, I think, was the beginning of the conversation that, you know, I'm sorry, the guest name again, I don't
Darrell, Darrell Kalika.
Yeah, and so it was great because you talked about, you know, why did you work for the federal government before coming home, so to speak, to deal locally. And how much that helps, because of course Elizabeth Warren is trying to use it. I don't feel she's trying to use it in a bad way, but whether or not it's helpful for what's happening around that issue in terms of she is in the federal government, she's possibly looking to run for as president, and how that ties in to, I guess, that one issue of cultural appropriation of resources. And when I think of resources, I don't just think of things in the ground or underground or on top of ground, but it's also resource is culture. So when you're talking about First Nations culture, how this whole issue, which of course is distracting from a lot of the Native American women or First Nations women who are running for offices. I hate to go around and around, but basically, is it a positive or is it a negative what's happening around Elizabeth Warren?
Thank you, Sean.
So, I'm looking at this situation. I kind of have to go back to my own reflection of this notion of stewardship. You know, and part of it is we all kind of as Native people are at different places in terms of our life journey and where our Indigenous identity, our culture, spirituality all play in our lives. We're at different levels of that. And, you know, I think some people are re-engaging or are finding their Indigenous roots. But I think with finding that comes also a responsibility. And that's where I bring up the notion of stewardship, that with that responsibility as a Native and Indigenous person means to begin to learn and identify what that means. Beyond just being, as some people say, a card-carrying citizen of a tribal nation, you don't necessarily have to be an enrolled citizen of a tribal nation to be an Indigenous person. And so I think with her discovery or identification through DNA of her Native identity really just kind of confirms a genetic connection. But now I think it's incumbent that she, you know, or any person in that situation start to understand what does that mean? What, beyond just having sort of this genetic link, also in terms of our social identity means, well, now you need to understand what that means to you and how you carry that forward. So this also could be an opportunity for her to step in and say, well, now as a descendant or as having a connection to this community outside of just, you know, in theory or what her family has told over time, taking on and learning about what that means, learning the plight of Indigenous people, of Indigenous women, you know, and being able to engage at a deeper level of what that's going to mean. I do have a concern about, you know, sort of some of the tribal government response of sort of saying, well, it's sort of tangential and meaningless. I think it's another opportunity for tribal governments to say, hey, Elizabeth, sister, let's help you understand some of the issues that are really important to us right now. Housing, VAWA, healthcare, you know, so you could be a champion for some of these things.
VAWA.
VAWA is the Violence Against Women Act.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes. Thank you. And thanks to Sean for calling with that question. I'll take this moment to remind other folks who may like to call in and join the conversation or pose another question for our guest. The number is 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187. And for those who may have just joined us in the past few minutes, you are listening to KBOO. We are Native Voices from the Edge, and we have Darrell Kalika joining us this morning. So let's shift gears. Well, before we shift gears, we've got Phil on line one. Phil, you're live.
Good morning. I want to acknowledge that I'm the silly person who called in to the studio a week ago about Measure 103. And uh-huh. I'm really, really pleased with your answer. And don't feel so bad because it gave you a chance to give the message again.
Yes. True. Agreed. Thank you, Phil.
Now, in the matter of Elizabeth Warren and high-placed people in government, not necessarily highly First Nations or whatever, let's remember Bill Bradley, Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey. He really inspired me that we were maybe coming to an era of honor and fairness to the people who lived here first. And it seems that hope kind of got trounced on, and I hope we could get back on a footing toward some reparations. Mm. And that's all I want to say right now.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks,
Phil. Glad to close the loop on that one. Great. So, shifting gears here. I'd love to learn more about the Institute for Tribal Government. Could you give a little background on the history of how this came to be?
So the Institute for Tribal Government came about because change is a constant. Elections are ongoing in India country because every tribe is a sovereign government, so they establish their election cycles. So pretty much any season of the year in the country, especially in the United States or in the Pacific Northwest, which, you know, my footprint of is really focused there on the tribal governments here. We were looking at the sort of parallel organizations that serve state governments. You have like the National Conference of State Legislatures, which helps new legislators learn their role, learn how to be a legislator. Don't really have something like that for new tribal leaders. Because the array of tribal leaders, you've got folks that are coming in with professional degrees to people who may have not finished school or, you know, finished school or got a GED. So you have this diverse array of folks there. So what the Institute for Tribal Government was established by former Congresswoman Elizabeth Furse and then the late Roy Samsel, who was a assistant secretary for the BIA and Department of Interior. And so the two of them were the two that sort of championed this, along with the support of many retired and serving elected tribal leaders, to say, let's get this up and going. And they approached, at the time, I was working at actually for Senator Gordon Smith when they were working on this initiative to establish this and stand it up. And Portland State University was identified to be the home because of the Mark Hatfield School of Government. And Mark Hatfield playing an important role for tribes, particularly those that were getting restored back in the 80s. And so the Institute for Tribal Government was set up nearly 20 years ago. I'm actually the first, Don Sampson was the first Native person to serve in that from the Confederate Tribes Umatilla, but I'm the first Native woman to serve as the director role for the Institute for Tribal Government. And so one of the things that we're working on, we continue to have direct services, help tribal governments. We also work with new tribal governments after election cycles to help them identify their strategy for their term of office. But we're also working with the government partners that engage with tribes. Really had focused initially with federal government, but now we're seeing, especially in this administration, a change in terms of the increased involvement from state governments and local and county government as well. So
let's hold this right here. Thank you so much. We have a caller on the line, Harry. Are you there?
Is this our friend, Harry?
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. The questions I have for our guest is, I'm a Portland State University alumni. I was wondering, what was your degree in, and did they have a Native American student union there?
They did. My degree was in political science, and at the time I was there, there was the United Indian Students, or what is it?
Higher
now
it's now education,
but I think it's now United Indigenous Students.
Oh.
Higher education. As well as the American Indian Science and Engineering Society were the two organizations that were prominent then. At the time, we had a small office in Smith Memorial Union. We did not have a Native American Student and Community Center, but yeah, that was kind of my background there.
Oh, okay. The next question is, this in September was the salmon run up the Columbia River. And I wanted to get some salmon from, some Native American fishermen or from the tribes. But all they said was go to the Bridge of the Gods and right below there you can buy some. And I'm thinking, don't they have a cannery? I mean, I would pay a premium price if I could buy a can of salmon that said a Warm Spring Salmon Run of 2018. I'll pay a premium. Where can we find salmon? I mean, because it's not available in Portland.
No, that's an excellent question. In terms of, there have been over the years efforts by the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission to stand up sort of a tribal fishing market or be able to market tribal salmon and fisheries. But absent that, there are a number of folks that are individual entrepreneurs who do sell salmon. Of course, one of those being in Cascade Locks. You have some individual folks. Brigham Fisheries actually owns a store right there in Cascade Locks. I think I know it says Brigham in their store title. Another entity is Salmon King Fisheries, which is owned by a tribal member from Warm Springs. She sells her salmon to, I think, some of the local grocers here in the city of Portland. I'm not exactly sure which ones, maybe New Seasons or Whole Foods. I don't necessarily know if it says, you know, caught by Northwest Tribal Fisher women or men. But yes, there's definitely an effort to do that. The other piece, though, I would say is that part of when we were talking about that harvestable catch is a good portion of that harvestable catch that tribal members are catching is subsistence fishery for their own families. Some of that is also going to the tribe, which specifically my tribe, using as an example at Warm Springs, that we have some of our fishermen that are sort of filling the community's freezer, if you will, for things like funerals, memorials, and root feasts, huckleberry feasts, and so forth. So some of that salmon actually goes back to the community in addition to being distributed by their families. So there's mm-hmm. some limitations on what can be sort of sold commercially, but yeah, for now, right, is Cascade Locks is really the best place to find fishermen that are selling.
Okay, the next question, of course, is what happened to the Caneta Resort? And is there any plans of remodeling and maybe opening it up again?
So I think that it's a challenge right now with particularly Caneta in terms of some of the skeleton of its infrastructure needs some heavy investment to bring it up to sort of a modern, usable state. I think that the tribe is definitely is open to looking at options with regard to the future of Caneta. But as many tribes undergo sort of transition and experiences during with their economies, I think that's kind of where we are with kind of Caneta suffering a bit of the pieces of that.
Okay, the next question is the BPA, Bonneville Power Administration, do the tribals get any funding from them since the dam is crossing the whole Columbia and some of the other dams?
Mm. So there are some investments and resources that are put forward. It's called the Federal Columbia River Power System, or FCRPS program, that looks at both fisheries mitigation and protection, as well as cultural resource mitigation and protection. And the tribes all along the Columbia are participants in those processes and work groups. Additionally, BPA's Tribal Affairs program has annual competitive funding available to tribes that are not just immediate directly affected, but are served by Bonneville or Bonneville's customers. And so the tribes have different methods for being able to access resources from BPA. But I will say this, there's one concern that we are having with Bonneville Power Administration is the fact that natural gas is now cheaper than buying hydropower. So that raises some concern about the future of BPA in terms of having long-term customers buying their hydropower. So that is a concern.
Oh, okay. Yes. And the last question I have is to our host. thank you for the shout out last week about the dollar coins.
It is you, Harry.
Yeah. And I want you to keep in mind also, maybe next time you take over the KB radio show, you might do a show on Native Americans on U.S. postage stamps.
Oh, yes.
Love this idea.
Yes.
Harry, you're such a needed contributor. Thank you for calling in, and thank you for just throwing up good conversations.
Yes, appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Harry.
Have a nice day.
You too. I know we've got two more callers on the lines, but I also just wanted to take a moment in response to Harry's question about where to find tribal caught salmon. You know, there are several native marketplaces that are coming up, especially throughout November, Native American Heritage Month. So if folks have access to Facebook, just type in Native Marketplace and check out the events. But we've got lots of them. I think I saw one at the Great Spirit United Methodist Church on November 10th. There's the Native American Runway and Marketplace on November 17th. Native American Family Day and Marketplace on, well, it says November 25th from 2017, but the city of Portland hosts one. There's so many marketplaces coming up. Oh yeah, the Indigenous Come Up Indigenous Winter Marketplace on November 23rd. So, so many opportunities.
That's true.
Yes.
We have another caller. Yes. Meridian, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. Thank good you morning. So much for taking my call.
Thank you.
I was hearing some questions earlier about Initiative 1631 on the Washington ballot here this November 6th, and I wondered if you'd like a little bit more information about it. And then I heard the comment about BPA and the cost of hydro when natural gas is being priced so low, and I think that 1631 would actually help, you know, tilt the balance towards renewable energy. That's what it's all about.
Wonderful. And yes, I think we all need more info, especially for our listeners up in Vancouver who may be voting in this election. Do you have a quick nutshell or a resource that you can point folks to?
Yeah, absolutely. The yeson1631.org website, or don'tspoilwa.org. Both great resources.
Don't spoil law?
WA. W-A.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I was wondering what that means. So, don't spoil law.
Don't spoil law, yeah.
Yes.
So 1631 is going to, is supported and written by the largest alliance and coalition in state history, and it includes organizations like the American Lung Association, the League of Women Voters, and the Nature Conservancy, and tenant unions, and tribes, and lots of people from lots of walks of life sat at a table and put this policy together. The only people who weren't at the table were the oil companies, and so they're spending almost $22 million to defeat it.
Wow.
So if you remember how last year we were trying to end the Tesoro oil terminal threat over here in Vancouver, and we had a big fight with Tesoro. Well, Tesoro is one of the big donors. They've spent over $4.3 million so far to try to defeat 1631.
That's so obnoxious.
So there's a lot of it seems like they're on track to spend more money to try to defeat this than has ever been spent to defeat an initiative. And it is, because it's so crucial. If we are able to start investing in more clean energy and help more people have access to making better choices about where they're getting their energy from, and if we're able to put thousands of people to work in clean energy jobs and invest in forests and waterways, and doing that by having the people who are creating a tremendous amount of pollution with both short-term and long-term ramifications, hold them accountable. That's it's right. Their mess. Let them be held accountable for the mess they're making, and let us use some of that to invest in a healthy future. So that's what the 1631 is all about, and it's on the November 6th ballot. It's the first thing on the Clark County ballots when you on the initiative. It's the number one question there, and it's a yes.
Love
thank
it.
You so much, yes, Meridian. You know, we love
Meridian.
Clean energy.
That's right. That's right. We're having a conversation with Confam from the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon 2 weeks ago about the big business money that's been dumped in to the opposition against Portland Clean Energy Initiative.
Right.
So folks need to be aware of the resources
that's
that are
right.
being dumped in.
And we've got
democracy.
another caller, Dennis.
Yes, I have a question about, what's happening. There's something that's happening in North Dakota, the tribes in North Dakota, which is just frightening. The Republicans there are trying to get some initiative to have to require that the street addresses be put on the IDs for people, I think that's it. I don't know. I came in late. Maybe you've discussed this. If that's just that, the tribes there don't have street addresses, and so that would be a great hurt, do a lot of hurt to the Democratic Party there, and because the tribes there are support the Democratic Party and Heidi Heitkamp. I don't know if you know this, these issues, but I was wondering, is there anything similar to that happening in Oregon and Washington State? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Voter suppression in North Dakota. I haven't heard of anything like that happening here.
And I have not either, but I do understand and have been informed, actually, at the AT&I convention that there are some efforts because the Native vote played such a critical role in the last two election cycles, especially the presidential election cycles, that some efforts have been made to try to neutralize the Native vote in particularly states where there is a large Native population. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, so that is definitely out there as a concern. But with regard to things like the Dakota Access Pipeline, there have also been initiatives to try to minimize or limit the ability for tribes to protest or rally against those by exercising racketeering laws to prevent tribal people from gathering to protest some of these things. Mm. So.
Yes, thank you for that question. So we've got just a couple minutes before we're wrapping up.
That's true.
So do you have any reflections, Darrell, on how folks can foster that idea of stewardship in promoting the vision of the tribes here?
Well, I think it's kind of taking an assessment and inventory at a personal level, and then you start to see how that trickles out to sort of your family, your neighborhood, your region and city. And so when you start to look at those things that you want to take care of, when you want to take care of your health and how that's all kind of built upon itself, in terms of stewardship, I think that's being a good steward starts with you. Being a good sovereign starts with the exercise of your own inherent sovereignty as an individual person. And I think part of that comes to taking responsibility and owning the decisions that you make with your dollar, the things that you choose to purchase, knowing where they come from, knowing where your food comes from, I think is all an important part of that. And then being able to employ those principles in sort of your daily life, I think play a role. And I think over the long term that taking those principles have a lasting effect. And so especially as people are going into the election cycle, thinking about their exercise of their personal sovereignty and who they're choosing to vote for or not vote for, or what initiatives they're voting for or not voting for.
And then just another note for folks listening, is there a way that people can support or get involved with the work that you're doing for the Institute for Tribal Government or for AT&I?
Yes, definitely. Of course, one of the things we are both, the Institute for Tribal Government is at Portland State University, so you can find us there just by typing in the Institute for Tribal Government and PSU. We'll take you right to our page. We're always looking for donations. Our donations actually fund a scholarship for students at PSU. It's the Roy Memorial Scholarship. And then AT&I is at www.atnitribes.org. Is a nonprofit organization, so of course people can find out what's going on or donate as well.
And AT&I does also post really good updates on social media too. I follow the
page. On Facebook.
True. Just a little plug.
Thank you.
Perfect. Well, Darrell, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I hope that folks will follow up and learn more and consider what that looks like to be good stewards. Along those lines, looking ahead next week, we are so excited to have some tenants join us to talk about their organizing for tenant protections. So please join us again when that conversation takes place. Coming up next, we've got Press Watch at 9, Fight the Empire at 9:30 a.m., followed by Air Cascadia at 10. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, In Between the Covers.
talking about.
Like the pause there. You're like, what? What is that?
It's about a book. So, yes. And along the same lines of donations, all of these KBOO programs are made possible by volunteers and member support. So if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. With that, thank you so much to Heather for covering this morning with all of our callers, etc.
Yes.
And without further ado, I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack.
And this has been Native Voices, from the Edge.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. We are all one people and we have to reunite. I said better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, we have Press Watch at 9 with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire. Pair talks to journalist Daniel Lazaro about his latest article that asks, is Saudi Arabia the Middle East's next failed state? At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with author Dubravka Ugrechlik about her new novel, Fox, and a revised and updated essay collection, American Fictionary.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Friends of Noise October Youth Showcase on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Rockwood Center in Portland. Local bands The Day, White Lotus, and Seven will be playing the Friends of Noise Youth Showcase this month. Friends of Noise is a nonprofit that works to create more space for all ages music and arts and aims to open a music and arts venue. Again, that's the Friends of Noise October Youth Showcase featuring The Day, White Lotus, and Seven on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Rockwood Center, 17805 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Come up in the party.